Committee to order. It's March 18th. It's 3:35. The members in attendance are Senator Elton, Senator Ben Stevens, Senator, I can't even remember the name half the time, Bert. I want to say Bert. Bert Stedman and myself, Tom Wagoner. We'll be joined shortly by Senator Seekins and Senator Guest. So, Senator French, we'll turn the floor over to you. And online, we have Deborah Vogt, and she is going to help you make the presentation. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Is Fred going to be gone?
Yeah, Fred's not going to be there. So, this is by invitation only, testimony by invitation only on Senate Bill 50, Oil Severance Tax. And the way we've set this up is Senator French has 45 minutes for presentation and then questions and answers from the committee. And then when he's through, Alaska Oil and Gas Association will have 45 minutes for their presentation. I expect to adjourn around 5 o'clock, maybe 10 after 5. We got getting a little late start. So, Senator French.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
What's your intent to do today?
I'm not going to move the bill. I'm going to hold the bill.
Why not?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I may. Appreciate you taking the time to hear the bill, and I'll try to be as succinct as I can. I think the question that is in front of the committee today is, did we achieve perfection 16 years ago, the last time we made a major change to the oil taxation structure in the state? And I'll be suggesting that the answer is no, and I'll be suggesting that the answer to that question requires us to take a good hard look at what we did 16 years ago, where we are today, and what we ought to do in the future. I know that you all are familiar with how the basic tax structure works here in the state, but to make sure we're all on the same page, I'm going to take about 2 minutes to just review very briefly the outline of oil taxation structure in Alaska. There's an elf in the Alaska oil taxes. There's four main taxes that the oil industry pays. There's the royalty, the 12.25%. That varies a little bit from lease to lease, but that's roughly true in most cases. There's a property tax of 20 mils per dollar, about 2%. There's a corporate income tax of about 9.4%. And then there's the production tax, which is actually about 12.5% for the first 5 years of a lease and then 15% afterwards. But in general, it's 15% before the ELF comes into play. The 15% production or severance tax varies because of the ELF or the economic limit factor. And at its simplest, the ELF is simply a number between 0 and 1. You multiply the production tax of a field by the field's ELF, and that always works to lower the field's tax burden. Now here's a couple of examples. Kuparik's ELF for fiscal year 2006 is going to be 0.054. If you multiply 0.054 times 15, that gives you 0.081. That means Kuparik is going to pay a 0.81% production tax, a little less than 1%. Prudhoe's ELF, on the other hand, is quite a bit bigger. It's 0.8435. And when you multiply that times 15, you get their total production tax of 12.65%. The formula is actually quite complex, and the basic factors that go into how it's calculated, it boils down really to total oil production and daily well production from each producing field. Those are the main factors in the ELF calculation, but that's the calculation straight out of the statute book. Now, one of the things I'm going to talk about over and over is how ELF was designed to encourage small field development. But when you go back and look at what they meant by small in 1989, I think you'll find that it's different from what most people mean when they say small. Back in 1989, the two big fields were Prudhoe, the biggest field in North America, and Kuparik, the second biggest field in North America. Everything else in North America falls under two of those fields. So when you say small, in those days, they meant something less than a giant field. And I think nowadays, we take a much different view of what small means. And so I think this is one of the fundamental assumptions that allowed for the ELF to be constructed the way it was, that turned out, with 16 years of hindsight, to be not a perfect assumption. It's an assumption that you should probably go back and revisit. There are 20 separate little fields up on the north slope, and even after the governor made his aggregation move, even after the governor took those satellite fields of Prudhoe, put them all into Prudhoe and said they're going to pay the same ELF as Prudhoe and the same severance tax as Prudhoe, there are still 9 operating fields on the north slope that pay 0 production tax. In 2003, we took in about $599 million in production taxes. The average price that year was $28 a barrel. And the average ELF was about 0.50, meaning the average production tax was 7.5%. I want to spend a few minutes talking about Kuparuk and its neighbors, because I think this is a good example of some of the assumptions that underlay the ELF from 1989 and the way it's working out in practice. And this is a diagram taken straight out of an oil industry publication that shows the Kuparuk field, which is in gray, and the two fields that lay in the same geography as the Kuparuk field, the huge Westsac field and the smaller Tabasco field. Now, this bill would exempt Westsac and Tabasco because they're both heavy oil. They're both oil less than 20 API gravity. And because of the unique difficulties you have in producing that oil, this bill would leave those fields untouched. But there are two smaller fields, two satellite fields near Kuparuk, Tarn and Meltwater, that I'd like to take a few minutes and look at a little more closely. The Tarn field made 696,248 barrels in January of 2005. That's a number straight from the state's own webpage. That's about 22,450 barrels of oil a day. It's made 65 million barrels of total oil to date, making it, according to the same oil publication where I got the map, one of the top 30, one of the 30 largest oil fields in the United States. Tarn has a tiny ELF, a 0.013 ELF, meaning it will pay a 0.2% production tax, a fifth of 1% in 2005, and its ELF is going to go to zero in 2007. So one of the largest oil fields in the United States, under the ELF that we built in 1989, is paying one-fifth of 1% of production tax. Tarn is produced via Kuparuk's facilities, and this is the other assumption, which I think turned out to have been a bad assumption from 1989. Because in 1989, when they said satellite fields, they didn't give a lot of thought to the type of infrastructure that was going to be necessary to produce oil on the North Slope. As it turns out, the satellite fields are piggybacking onto existing infrastructure. The Kuparuk BOC you see here, this is the base of operations. You can see that's a 727 airplane sitting on a 5,000-foot gravel runway to give you some idea of the scale. The orange is the camp. The brown is also power generation in that area right there, and auxiliary camp. That's the main gathering center where the oil and the gas is separated. And those are two 100,000-barrel divert tanks to give you some idea of the scale. Tarn didn't require a sea lift and a bunch of facilities to go to the North Slope for it to produce its oil. Tarn is produced basically by two drill sites and three 10-mile pipelines. That's what it took to bring the Tarn oil field online. A fairly modest capital outlay by the oil industry compared to the huge expenditures that a unique field startup requires. The Meltwater field, which was also in one of these satellites, is produced through Kuparuk's facilities. It required one drill site only. And in 2003, it produced about 5,800 barrels of oil per day and paid no production tax. This rather modest field will make the producers 2 million barrels of oil this year. At $50 a barrel, that's $100 million. This week, I called a friend of mine who is a drilling supervisor for Schlumberger. And I said, what does it cost? What are you guys charging to drill oil wells on the North Slope? He said, it's between $2 and $8 million. And he said, if you sign the contract today, I'll take you to lunch at Humpy's. I said, well, you know, we'll have to think about it. But if the meltwater field is making 5,800 barrels a day, it's probably coming from between 4 and 6 wells. So even if you take that high figure, that $8 million figure to drill an oil well to completion, that's $48 million capital outlay for all the drilling for a field that's making $100 million a year in revenue. Chances are those wells cost less. It's hard to find out. It's hard to break down those costs by well and get that kind of information from the industry.
You say the oil companies are making $100 million a year. What's the state's share of total revenue that comes from that per year then?
We would definitely get the 12.5% royalty. We would get, the North Slope Borough would get their 2% property tax. And then there's the corporate income tax of 9.4%. So those are incomes of the state. Senator Seekins, through the chair. How the fair share bill would work is this. There's two principal reforms that the bill sets out. The first simply establishes a minimum 5% production tax. All fields must pay the minimum 5%. You could think of it as a sales tax. You could think of it as saying every field in the state is going to pay 5%. That's going to be what you pay to produce oil from state or federal leases, for that matter, to the state. In January 2004, the Department of Revenue estimated this provision alone would raise $75 million at $22 a barrel. Second major reform bases the ELF on the price of a barrel of oil. And this is a major change. As the price rises, so does the ELF. As the price of oil falls, so does the ELF. The bill sets a $16 to $20 range of oil as the norm and allows this range to increase with inflation to recognize prices rise over time. At lower oil prices, the production tax would be reduced. If oil goes to $12 a barrel, the formula would divide 12 by 16 to yield 0.75. The production on an oil field would be reduced by 25%. And I really want to stop and talk about this for a minute, because if this provision were not in the bill, I wouldn't be sitting in front of you today presenting it. It was very important to me that this bill had this provision, because I believe that to be fair, you have to recognize that we are to a large degree a partner with the oil industry, and that when they are experiencing very hard times, when they're experiencing low oil prices, their economic viability is threatened, and they could consider shutting in wells, laying off jobs during those difficult times. And so it was important to me to make certain that the bill had it's only fair to lower taxes at lower prices so that we don't, in essence, tax the industry out of existence during economic hard times.
Senator Stevens.
I'm wondering, Senator, how you established this norm, the $16 to $20 a barrel. In looking at the Department of Revenue's long-term price expectation for that oil, we're looking at at least $25.50. I mean, wouldn't you be basically saying that you're building into it a structural increase, or that you'll never get below this norm if the long term is looking at around that $25 range?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, it's our belief that it's almost impossible to predict future oil prices, but that the real key is not what the prices are going to be. The real key is preserving the economic viability of the companies and the fields that are in place. And it's our belief that the $16 to $20 range establishes that.
And I was just thinking, because if we're saying, okay, if this is a fair way of looking at it, it just seemed to me, no matter what you did, based on no one is predicting oil to get back to 16 to 20, that it's a fair feature that the probabilities are you'd never exercise, based on what I see for forecasts for oil for the long term. But go ahead.
Senator, to that point, I don't want to belabor it, but it seems to me that the way you would want to establish where that tipping point is not necessarily in what the price of oil may or may not be, but what the cost of production might be. And so if you establish cost of production at X dollar, you know, $8 or $9 higher than that would seem to be a fair tipping point.
Okay, go ahead.
If oil prices fall below $10 a barrel, as they did back in 1984 and 85, the bill would waive half the production tax and would defer the other half until prices rise above $16 a barrel. At higher prices, $30 in oil, for example, the new formula would yield 30, would divide 30 by 20, yielding 1.5. You basically take the price, divide by 20, and get the new factor. And a field with a 10% production tax would pay an adjusted 15% production tax at these higher prices. However, the bill puts an ultimate cutoff at 25%, not allowing the production tax to ever exceed 25%. The bill also exempts heavy oil, as I mentioned. I'm sorry.
So you're capping at 25. What made you cap it at 25%?
Again, I think there's just an ultimate question of fairness there, Chairman Wagner. If oil prices go to $100, this formula would produce an unreasonably large bite at those higher figures. And the way the calculation works out, as you'll see later on, is that you produce a curve that seems, I guess, in essence, fair to each side. It produces roughly equal share of profit between the industry and the state.
Okay, I just want to ask you one other part to my question. It seems rather excessive to require 25% under your bill, when in fact, and I don't want to get in a big argument, but the state has no risk. They have no upfront investment with venture capital, and yet we're asking for 25%. Now, I can understand increasing taxes if the state had some risk here, but we have no risk. Matter of fact, we have 12.5%. We got, 9.4% taxes for corporate taxes. And, of course, North Slope takes most of our property tax. But so I just trying to see where the fairness is. And being a businessman myself and having had some businesses, if somebody was taxing me at 25%, I'd run away and hide, I think. Senator Seekins?
What's the maximum tax now, production tax? Isn't it about 15%?
That's the maximum, although, to be fair, no field pays 15.
So if we looked at the maximum, then, and you're proposing that we raise it to 25%, we're basically raising it about, 65% over the maximum now, another 65%, 65, 66, somewhere in there? Is that what you're proposing, that we raise the maximum by another 65%?
Okay.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, the bill exempts heavy oil. We've talked about that, given the fact that it's expensive and difficult to produce. The bill also allows taxpayers production tax relief, much like the royalty tax relief we passed a couple of years ago. If the taxpayer can demonstrate that the field would be economical but for the production tax, you can demonstrate that by clear and convincing evidence to the Department of Revenue, then the department has the power to waive the tax for that field. To make certain that the truly marginal fields, the fields that are truly on the cutting edge, the yes-no edge of development and exploration, don't get lost, don't fall off the table because of this bill. Why should we make a change? Here's what Dan Dickinson, the current director of the Tax Division, said a year ago to the Petroleum News. He said, despite its name, economic limit factor, the current ELF ignores the biggest single economic determinant, which is price. That's the missing link in the current ELF formula. Why make a change? As Senator Seekins has pointed out, a year ago, National Geographic, when oil was just going north of $30 a barrel, $32, $33, $34 a barrel, the world began to realize that we may be at the end of cheap oil. Current oil demand and usage each day is about 80 million barrels per day. It's an astonishingly large figure. Why make a change? According to the Wall Street Journal, just 2 weeks ago, the spike in oil prices is likely again in 05. The Wall Street Journal noted that as oil prices approached a new high yesterday, industry analysts said they are anticipating price increases to more than $60 a barrel this year, and it may even go north of there. And as oil prices go up, the industry is doing very well. ExxonMobil's fourth quarter 2004 profits were the biggest quarterly profit by a United States company ever in history, $8.4 billion. BP did very well themselves, $4.4 billion in the fourth quarter. ConocoPhillips made $2.4 billion in the fourth quarter. If you add that up, that's $15.2 billion in profits in 90 days. That's $7 million in profits per hour. That's after you deduct every single cost that you can imagine. Exploration, lease sales, pipe, corporate jets, salaries, bonuses, lobbying fees. After all of that comes out, you're left with $15.2 billion.
You're talking internationally, though. You're not talking
worldwide. Yes, sir. Worldwide. We don't have separate accounting. It's worldwide. It's,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, if I'm just kind of curious if, rather than looking at the total dollars they make, because each corporation around the country has different capital structures and costs and equity positions, what's their rate of return on their equity?
There's some this data came to you from reports I printed off a Charles Schwab website, and the backup data may have that on there. I've seen the number, but I can't quote it to you.
Senator, I don't, Mr. Chair, and Senator Simmons, I don't know what it is for the other companies, but I think it's 25% risk.
I'm sorry, Mr.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about one of the great individuals in the history of our state, Governor Hickel. And a few years back, he wrote a book and gave a speech, and the title of both was The Crisis in the Commons, an Alaskan Solution. And when he says commons, he was talking about how the oceans are owned in common. No one can homestead the ocean. And he was talking about the huge amounts of state and federal land in Alaska and in other countries, Australia, Canada, and so forth. About how nobody owns those, or nobody can homestead them. And it really provokes you into some thinking about how you manage that land, how you manage those commons for the maximum good. And he made some really interesting remarks in the course of that speech and in the course of the book. I wound up going down and getting a copy of it, and I haven't read all of it, but I've read the first half of it, and I look forward to finishing it. And he said that few world leaders are thinking about how we should care for and use the commons for the benefit of the total. And he was talking some about Alaska and about how the fishing and the timber companies have exploited Alaska in the past. And he was also, to be fair, talking about Africa, where he saw poor people living on very rich land. And it bothered him. And he wound up saying that especially for the benefit of the local population, rather than for a political leader, a ruling family, an oligarch, or a group of multinational corporations. And then he goes back and kind of explains the history of how we got to where we are as far as statehood and mineral leasing and the oil on the North Slope. And he pointed out that this movement began in 1909 when President Roosevelt began the process of separating the ownership of land from the minerals below. Governor Hickel was raised in Kansas, where and the homesteading there was done such that if you bought the land on top, you owned everything underneath. And when the oil rush came there, everyone was in a big hurry to poke as many holes as you could in the ground, because the quicker you poked a hole in the ground, you could produce not only the oil that was underneath your property, but you might get your neighbors as well. And that wasn't really a good way to do business. And so President Roosevelt started to take a different view of this. And as Governor Hickel points out, the Mineral Leasing Act of 1920 recognized that the commons belonged to the public and required that income from the development of the commons be paid to the public's government. And he goes on to note that our Statehood Act was actually modeled on that 1920 Mineral Act. The subsurface energy resources were specifically designated to the new state of Alaska. And he makes a neat point when he says that the resource wealth was kept in public hands, harnessed the free enterprise system to develop the wealth, all in the framework of a constitutional democracy. Recently, a Wood McKenzie study was released, portions of it was released. And the thrust of that study was that Alaska is a more profitable place to do business than the average of almost 60 oil and gas producing regions surveyed worldwide. We have higher than average costs, but a lower than average government take at prices above $16 a barrel. But I think it's important, and one of the points they made over and over was that we are a more profitable place to do business than the average of the almost 60 other oil and gas producing regions. And they went on to say that at $35 a barrel, and this is in the backup material, you can look at their tables. I haven't read their whole study. I've just read what's been made available to the public. We're 19th out of 55, well above the median. At $35 a barrel, the total take is about 58%, compared to a global average of 73%. The difference between 58, which is what is taken in Alaska, and 73, which is taken the average, that's the midpoint worldwide, is 15%, and that amounts to a subsidy of the oil industry. We should be right smack in the middle. You don't want to tax too much, but you don't want to tax too lightly, or you're giving away your resource, the resource that is held in common, held in trust by all of us. Other countries...
Question, Mr. Chairman.
If I can back up.
I've never seen that Wood McKenzie study. I assume you have?
No, as I mentioned, I have not signed the confidentiality agreement. I'm working off of two pages of tables that were released to the public and were the subject of a news story, and they're in the backup material. You have those tables in the backup.
When you're talking about this, are we talking about the cost of government, but not necessarily the cost of getting the product to market? Do you know?
The profit, I'm not an expert in this, so I'd probably be better off to not comment directly and let you read the tables and make your own deductions.
Because being in business, I would look at my total cost as not only being the take from government, but what it cost me to get my product to market and what I could sell it for at that time.
And that's why they made the costs in Alaska are a little bit higher than elsewhere. I mean, we all know that. It costs more to do business on the North Slope of Alaska than it does to do business in Venezuela or in Nigeria or in Saudi Arabia. It's just farther away and colder and more difficult.
This is just talking about the take for government, is what you're saying.
It combines so that the total take, that is what's left out of the profitability, if you will, after your expenses, after your government expenses and your cost expenses.
At the wellhead or at the market? That would be my question.
I believe it includes transport. But again, I didn't study the Wood McKenzie methodology.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other countries are making adjustments. The United Kingdom has recently upped their minimum take. Argentina has introduced an export tax. Venezuela has removed heavy oil royalty incentives. And Nigeria has increased its share of government profit. And this is all from a news story out of Petroleum News, January 30, 2005. I want to briefly go over some of the arguments that you'll hear against this bill, but what you won't hear are folks talking a lot about how we lower taxes at low prices. And it's a key part of the bill. What you won't hear folks talking about is the fact the bill raises the normal range every year to account for inflation. There are many of us here who think that we should do this in lots of different areas, in education, for example, to account for health care expenditures. But we built this into the bill in order to try to be as fair as possible, because we recognize that every year costs go up. And they may not discuss the fact that it allows for production tax relief.
Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I go back to that slide? You've attempted to discuss these issues with them when you say that they won't? I mean, is it that they may not, or they won't, or they haven't, or what?
It's a rhetorical point, Senator Seekins, through the chair. The arguments I've seen made in the press and both with industry and private conversations have focused really on the fact that this raises taxes. And that's, I think, their chief objection to the bill. I think if we severed...
You don't know of anyone who's attempted to who's been denied?
As in refuse to answer the question?
I mean, to discuss.
I'm not sure how to answer your question.
Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, the comment was made that the proposed bill would tie in the tax into almost like it would be inflation-proofed? Is that, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
The normal range is set from $16 to $20. But over time, as inflation works to raise the price of everything else, that normal range would go up so that the higher taxation scheme would kick in at a higher price. It would also wouldn't give you a break. See what I'm saying? If it's 16 to 20 this year, it might be 17 to 21 next year, 18 to 22 the year after, 19 to 23 the year after. So that would move up, and it would, you would avoid paying higher taxes because of the of effects of inflation.
I guess I'll have to think about that a little bit because it, historically, I don't think oil prices and inflation are very highly correlated.
But costs are. I think costs are. Their health, it costs just as much to insure an oil worker for health insurance as it does a government worker. They got to go out and buy health insurance, and it's expensive. And the price of steel is going up, and the price of food tends to go up, and so all their costs over time just tend to go up. They've got to transport workers. They've got all the normal costs of doing business. You have them, Senator Seekins has them in his business, and it just tends to cost more every year. You know, the cost of electricity just seems to go up and up and up.
You left out workers' comp.
Sorry.
In 1989, there were several arguments made against changing ELF, and I just want to go through them very briefly because I don't want to take up too much of the other side's time. To the extent that production, net production stays in the ground, the permanent fund is going to be a loser because the royalties that would have been collected won't be collected. The oil is still on the ground where it doesn't do anybody any good. And that was said by Mr. Tom Williams, who's here today, working at the time for British Petroleum before the House Resources Committee. Morris Thompson said, my concern is any additional taxes on the oil industry will have an adverse effect on future drilling on the North Slope. This action will fundamentally impact not only the petroleum industry, but also the state's ability to encourage new economic development. Ben Odom, the senior vice president of ARCO, said this bill would place an onerous additional tax burden on the oil industry that would remove to other states or countries funds that would otherwise be spent on additional investments in Alaska. That's what we were told in 1989, but here's what really happened. Here's a diagram of pipelines, pads, and roads and gravel mines on the North Slope in 1977. Here's what it looked like in 1989 when the ELF was changed, and here's what it looks like today. There's been nothing but good development on the North Slope, and I'm hoping to see that line over there on the right push into Anwar sometime soon. I'm sure we all are.
However, just lately, ConocoPhillips announced that they're putting Orion on hold, and that's a direct effect of when the governor announced his change to ELF. And so how many more Orions are out there, and how many more times are the oil companies going to take their money that they had programmed for Orion, for instance, and take it elsewhere? That's the hit I see Alaska taking. And right now, these companies are investing billions of dollars a year, and it's going to take a lot of money just to stay level on the amount of oil we got coming down the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And if we change the tax structure now and we lose that production to keep that level on the flow down the pipeline, even if you increase the taxes, what's going to be the difference in those two lines as far as income to the state of Alaska? See, even if you raise taxes, if you lose development and lose production, you're still going to have a negative number there. That's my fear.
And I couldn't agree with you more. You've got to find the sweet spot or else you're doing yourself harm. But I our position, of course, is that in the last 16 years, the sweet spot has moved away from us and that we could safely increase taxes without hurting development and without hurting exploration. I'm going to skip through these next slides because I know I'm running short on time. I'd like to concentrate on this one. This is, I don't want to cut into time. I've got about 3 or 4 more minutes. In conversations between Hugh Malone and the industry.
You have about 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure the other side gets fair.
You got started late.
Fair hearing. In conversations between Hugh Malone, this is a testimony of Greg Erickson. He said in conversations between Hugh Malone and industry leaders in 1981 when the original ELF was crafted, the idea was to allow industry and the state to have equal portions of the oil revenue.
I think for a lot of us, that's an unusual idea to come across, and I can actually remember a conversation with one of the members of the committee back in Senate Finance the last time I made this presentation, and we talked about it, because the first time it came to me, I was surprised by it. I'm surprised that you could even consider having the state get an equal share with the industry. But that was part of the original conversation, or at least according to Greg Erickson, remembering it 8 years later. And as I thought about the assessment, I thought, you know, I need to do a little better than that. Even though Hugh Malone was present when Mr. Erickson made that statement, and even though he seemed like the kind of person, I never had the privilege to meet the man, but he seemed like the kind of person who would have corrected the record right at the moment, had he remembered it differently, it still kind of nagged me in the back of my mind. And so I actually, my staff did a great job of going back to the 1981 hearings and finding an exchange between Mr. Malone and Mr. Monty Taylor, who was with Exxon at the time. And they were talking about how we can set this tax rate right. And Mr. Taylor said, I think it would be much more fair for the industry and the state to get about the same share out of Prudhoe Bay, even though we're paying the expenses we made and the investment and so forth. And on the very next page of that transcript, which you have in your backup, Mr. Malone said, so you think it would be should be brought down to the point where the state and the industry get roughly equal shares? You'd like that better? And Mr. Taylor said, yes, sir. That was back in 1981. At this point, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stop, and I'd like to ask Deborah Vogt, who's been listening in, to offer her thoughts on the subject, introduce herself to the committee, and take a few minutes of your time. Deborah, are you there?
I am.
Please go ahead.
Can you hear me? How's my volume?
Volume seems about right.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. For the record, my name is Deborah Vogt, and I live in Haines. By way of introduction, I served this state for more than 20 years between 1978 and 1999. As an Assistant Attorney General, the Senior Hearing Officer at the Department of Revenue, and most recently as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Most of my career I dealt with taxes, and primarily with oil taxes, beginning in the late 70s with the litigation over Alaska's separate accounting income tax, which I took to the United States Supreme Court, where we prevailed. I dealt with the corporate income tax, I dealt with the oil and gas property tax, and I dealt with the severance tax. I just want to make a couple of points this afternoon. I know the time is short, and I hope you'll bear with me. Judy Brady of AOGA recently told the House Oil and Gas Committee that, quote, the challenge for public policymakers is to find the sweet spot that balances keeping Alaska competitive for new investments against taking a healthy share of profits for the state, end quote. And I think you were talking about that earlier. That is absolutely the exact question that needs to be answered. But I submit that under today's statutory scheme, we are a long ways from that sweet spot. Last year, Sir John Brown of British Petroleum announced that his company could meet all of its needs for operations and investment with $20 oil. And he announced at that time that it was his intent that revenue above that amount would be returned to the shareholders. Think about that for a minute. The company has all its needs for operations and investments at $20 oil. Granted, that number might be not be right for Alaska as compared to the rest of the world, but $20 is a very long way from $52.50, which is what ANS Crude was going for earlier this week. So where's the additional $30 a barrel going? And I guess I want to make the point again that these are our resources. These are our private industry, yes, but they are producing leases, oil that is leased from the state. It's our oil. They have the right to produce it, but it's different from other private industries like Alaska Airlines or somebody. Anyway, where's the additional $30 a barrel going? I don't know how many shareholders BP has in Alaska. I'm not one. Maybe some of you are. But by and large, that money is not staying in Alaska. $30 of excess revenue on every barrel of oil. Alaska produces almost a million barrels of oil a day. $30 on each of those barrels. $30 million a day. Boy, that's a lot of money. I read recently that the legislature intends to take, what is it, $7 million out of the permanent fund earnings this year to invest in gas line activities? That's $7 million on an annual budget. Compare that with $30 million a day. Now, I'm sure there are a thousand arguments why we shouldn't think about $30 as being excess or windfall revenue on every barrel of oil today. So let's be a little more conservative. The whole time I was around state government, the long-term forecast for the price of oil hovered in the neighborhood of $16 to $18. That's where it was when I left the state in 1999, and it has been there for the better part of 20 years. In the fall of 2004, and you folks were just talking about, that number is $25.50, and every indication is that the number will go a fair amount higher. But just leaving it at $25.50, that's $8 a barrel more than the relatively recent olden days. And that's a heck of a lot of money. At 900,000 barrels a day, 365 days a year, that's about $2.7 billion more money coming out of Alaska's natural resources than a few short years ago. So where is that sweet spot? How much of that money should we be keeping in Alaska? I'd like to say a couple of words about the state's overall petroleum revenue picture, and just I'll be very, very brief on this because you did talk about it, Mark. But first, royalties are not taxes. They are the state's ownership interest. We are, as I'm sure Judy Brady will emphasize, in exactly the same position that a private landholder would be. The royalties are the farmer's share, as it were, what they call an outside. The points I'd like to make about the royalty are that a lot of the royalties are not general fund money. They go straight directly into the permanent funds, which certainly benefits all Alaskans, but is not available for appropriation, not part of the unrestricted revenue. Second point about royalties is that we're not always the farmer. Earlier this week, the U.S. Senate passed legislation that would authorize really in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Royalties there would be go 50% to the United States and only 50% to the state. Second, the property tax. I think everybody knows that almost all of the property tax goes to municipalities. Finally, the corporate income tax. I've heard a couple of references to the corporate income tax being 9.4%. But this is something I know a whole lot about. And the corporate income tax is very poorly designed for taxing natural resource production. And because of this, the oil industry has never paid anywhere near the 9.4 statutory effective. Their effective tax rate has never come anywhere near the 9.4% rate. The second point about the income tax is that it's not sensitive to economics of Alaska. Because we tax on an apportioned worldwide basis, what's happening in Alaska affects the corporate income tax very, very indirectly. I make these comments as a way to emphasize that it's my belief that getting the severance tax right is very, very important. Think about it. None of these other revenue sources is a very good tool for finding that sweet spot between not discouraging investment, but getting the maximum benefit for Alaskans from their natural resources. Find that spot? Well, you could ask industry. What are they likely to tell you? The oil and gas corporations, like every corporation, have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to maximize profits. They are not going to tell you to make changes that are likely to cost them money. They are not going to make it easy for you to find that spot. In 1989, Hugh Motley, who was then Vice President of ARCO, told the legislature that if the oil changes that were under consideration then were passed, the bar would be shut in. Right now, as Senator French just pointed out, Copart pays less than 1% severance tax. That's their job, to make money for their shareholders. But you, Mr. Chairman, and the other members of this committee and the rest of the legislature have a fiduciary and a constitutional duty to the people of the state of Alaska to maximize the benefit of Alaska's natural resources for all Alaskans. So that's your job, to find that spot. And I submit that an honest look at the scheme we have today will show we'll show essentially what the Wood Mackenzie numbers show. That at low numbers, Alaska doesn't stack up very well. We might even be above that sweet spot. But at high prices, we are giving away way too much. The bill before you takes a very careful look at the question and addresses both high and low prices and draws a very intelligent solution. But you've got to study the question yourself and come to your own conclusion. I commend the committee for hearing this bill and Senator French for having the courage to introduce it or to sponsor it. I also commend the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee for hiring Chuck Buxton, formerly the Department of Revenue's Chief Petroleum Economist. You should all make good use of Chuck. You couldn't find a better person to help you find that sweet spot. I'm sure he'd give you his opinion, which you might or might not agree with, but he'll also give you the tools to develop your own opinion. And that's your job, and I submit you don't have a more important one. Thanks, Senator French. I don't want to... If I had more time, but I think that you're running out.
I think that's about right.
Deborah, do you have your comments in writing?
Scratchy writing, I could screw them up. Would you like me to send them?
Yeah, could you fax those to my office at 465-4779?
I'm a poor retired person. I don't have a fax machine.
Can I email them to somebody? You can email. Just call 465-4907. We'll give you an email address for it.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there questions of Ms. Volk? Thank you very much for your testimony, Deborah.
Thank you very much for the time.
And thank you, Mr. French.
Chairman, thank you.
Any questions of Mr. French? Senator French, excuse me.
Senator Seacon. Mr. Chairman, I maybe didn't hear Ms. Volk earlier, if she's still online. She talked about royalty share going to the permanent fund. I wonder if she could repeat what she said there.
Senator Stevens, is that?
Seacon.
By Constitution, 25% of the royalties go directly into the permanent fund, and I believe it's still the statutory law that another 25% go directly into the permanent fund. So it's just 50% of the royalties.
No, that was changed. That was House Bill 11 on the additional 25%. But that 25% didn't apply to all fields, just those newly discovered fields.
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware of that, but the Constitution still says 25% goes.
Yeah.
First
25%. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. Next we have to testify is Last Oil and Gas, be Judy Brady.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Judy Brady. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I have with me Tom Williams. Tom is the Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association Tax Committee, and he is going to be making the presentation today. Tom, as many of you know, was Director of the Division of Petroleum Revenue from 1975 to 1979, and he was Commissioner of Revenue under Governor Hammond from 1979 to 1982. He then went into private practice, worked for SERI, was counsel for SERI before he went to work for BP. He has degrees from Harvard, Stanford, and Princeton, and is a gentleman that I think knows probably more about oil and gas tax than a whole lot of people in the state. So Tom is going to go over our presentation for us, and then if you have any questions, I'll jump in at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Williams, and as Judy said, I'm chair of the AOGA Tax Committee. My employer is BP Exploration, and I work there as Alaska Tax Counsel. Today I'm speaking on behalf of AOGA and the Tax Committee. This slide shows the importance today and the importance in the future of oil and gas for Alaska's finances. This current fiscal year, 88% of the unrestricted general fund revenue is going to come from petroleum and 12% from non-petroleum sources. That's higher than normal. It's historically been a little closer to 80% than 90%. Looking forward over the coming decade, according to the Fall Revenue Sources Book by DOR, Department of Revenue, oil revenue is going to continue to provide three quarters or more of the unrestricted general fund revenues out through 2014. Two elements are critical to having it, in fact, come true. One is price and one is volume. Now, we don't have a lot that we can do about price, but volume is something that the state does have influence over, and that is because volume is a result of investment, and that's something we'll come back to. Very quickly, you've already seen this in Senator French's presentation, you've got the four elements of the state's fiscal system. Royalty, which comes from the land ownership. Last year, it was $1 billion in change to the general fund and almost $500 million to the permanent fund. Production tax was $652 million. This is where the ELF comes in, just with the production tax. The property tax, it's a property tax similar to a property tax you have on your own homes. The state is the assessor. It's a 2% or 20 mil tax. We pay tax on the same property to the municipality where it's located, and then we get a credit for the municipal tax against the state tax. This was created by the state, this system, in 1973 in the special session that year. We have the oil and gas corporate income tax, just under $300 million last year. Again, that represents about 88% of the total corporate income tax that the state collected. Now, there's two things I'd point out about this slide. The first is that looking at it from the general fund point of view and spendable money, petroleum accounted for just over $2 billion. But from our point of view, the other $750 million that went to the permanent fund and to the local municipalities is still part of the cost of doing business here. It doesn't show up in the budget calculus for the state, but it shows up in the calculus for the bottom line for us. The second thing is, again, to stress that the ELF is only affecting production tax. The royalty, the property tax, the corporate income tax are not affected by the ELF. Nor is some of the leases have net profit share provisions in them, and the net profit share provisions aren't affected either, except to the extent the ELF may reduce production tax as a cost, leading a greater net profit to be shared. So point number one, even if the ELF makes the severance tax or production tax zero, a field still pays full royalty to the state, for property taxes on its facilities, contributes fully to the owner's income taxes. It increases the netback value by lowering tariffs, and that's an important thing because that benefits all the fields, the ones that may not be paying severance taxes, but also the ones that are, and it benefits on the royalty side as well. The pipeline doesn't cost much different to operate at 1 million barrels a day or 800,000, but clearly, if you have 1 million barrels a day going through, the cost per barrel is going to be less. So that's by lowering the cost of transportation, you raise the netback value. I'm going to jump ahead. This is what we mean by netback. Oil starts up on the North Slope, goes down through the red line across Alaska, which is TAPS, down to Valdez, and then it goes by ship, the heavy black lines, to the west coast of the United States, to Seattle, Puget Sound area, to San Francisco Bay area, and to Los Angeles area. The spot price is quoted for delivery on the west coast at any one of those locations. Here we started off as an example, it's $25. Now the actual average marine transportation cost in fiscal 04 was $1.61, according to the Department of Revenue. TAPS tariff averaged $3.05. So that's just $4.66, almost $5 of transportation costs. So your net back at pump station one here, you subtract that $4.66 from $25 and you've got $20.34. That's what we mean by net back. The last point I'd make about the ELF is that the field is still creating Alaska jobs, even if it's not paying production tax. Now the production tax has already been explained very well to you, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. The ELF is multiplied times the base rate and the gross resource value. Now the gross resource value is the net back to the point where the oil is leaving the field and going into the pipeline. The costs of running the field are not counted for the purposes of this tax, just as they're not counted for royalty. It's simply the cost from where it leaves the field downstream. That's the transportation to get it to market. Those are costs that are subtractable. The ELF indeed depends on two parameters for oil, how big the field is in terms of barrels a day it produces, and what its well productivity is. What's the average rate per well? Gas on its side depends only on the average production rate per well productivity. The larger a field is, or the more productive its wells, the higher its ELF and the higher its tax rate. The thought is it's more profitable and can afford to pay more. The smaller its field size or the lower its well productivity, the less profitable it is, and the lower its ELF is, the lower its tax. That's the how it works. Now you've seen this methodology. One thing I want to point out here is that this methodology applies regardless of what the price is. If you started with a West Coast price, say, of $10, and you subtracted, since I can do the math in my head, let's just call it $5 of transportation instead of $4.66. If I subtract $5 out, that leaves me a net back of $5. Now, if the West Coast price triples, to $30. My transportation costs remain $5. Now I have a wellhead or netback of $25. It's quintupled. That's how Alaska is leveraged by price. ELF does not have price as a specific parameter in it, but ELF, the tax, has price in it in its overall composition. Now, why do we have an ELF? I have to confess that the ELF is an idea that I thought of when I was the Director of Petroleum Revenue for the state. Back in 1976, in December, I wrote a memo suggesting that the idea behind the ELF. I'm not going to say that yet because I'm first going to say why we wanted to have it. We wanted to have a high-rate production tax. And we didn't want to have the consequences that a high-rate production tax would have later in a field's life. And here's what the department said, which is in 1977, and it's, again, prose that I'm responsible for. As operating costs rise, the profit margin shrinks during the life of a field. Production tax contributes to the total costs and tends to hasten the time when this break-even point, called the economic limit, is reached. Now, what is the consequence that this means then? Here you see an example of a field, and these represent the gross value of the barrels at different stages of a typical field's life. The first stage is when the field has first come on production. The costs are as low as they're ever going to be. The top part, the green, represents the state's 1/8 royalty share. The red part underneath it represents a 15% severance tax rate on the other 7/8. In stage one, the little sliver of black at the bottom of the barrel is the cost of producing that barrel. As this resource is non-renewable, the easy barrels come out first. It gets harder and harder and more expensive over time to produce them. And so you see as you go through stage two, stage three, and stage four, the black part of each barrel rises. The royalty remains the same because it's unaffected by the cost of producing that oil. The red part, the severance tax, is unaffected without an ELF because it too is based on the value of the oil without regard to the cost of getting it out of the ground. So you can see in stage three, as costs have risen of getting oil out of the ground, you've got a very narrow margin left being squeezed for the producer. And in stage four, you actually have a loss. The crosshatched area there, which is red and black, shows that the same value of the barrel is being counted twice, once to pay the severance tax and again to cover the costs. And so that little wedge is a loss.
Senator
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Tom, I just want to make sure I understand. This graph assumes that the price of oil is the same at stage one as it is at stage four?
No. No, this is going to happen regardless. It will happen at Prudhoe Bay or any other field. That's how fields end. They go through this evolution. It doesn't necessarily depend on what the absolute size is. The point is to illustrate that what happens with respect within that value.
So if I could just make sure I understand. So Tom, if the price of a barrel of oil at stage one is $25, and the price of the barrel of oil at stage four is $50, these colors stay the same on your graph?
Yes, these colors would stay the same. The point is that I can construct you a very plausible field that at $50 is going to be losing money. And in fact, I can tell you that Prudhoe Bay at $50, whether it's at the market or at the netback, someday will lose money. It isn't now, but it will someday. It's inevitable. That's why fields get shut in. Those costs keep going up and up as more and more of the oil that's extractable is produced. It gets harder and harder to get the next one out, and more expensive.
Let me rephrase it then. But in that situation that you just described, the period of time between stage one and stage four would be extended.
Absolutely. These are not, there's no time dimension to this graph, this chart.
And there's nothing that says they stay constant because of the price fluctuation, right?
No, at any given time, you could see this change. But this is the long-term trend. It's snapshots during the evolution of the field, not a continuous steady progression. You can have times like in December of 1986 when the West Coast price was $8.16. Even Prudhoe Bay had a crosshatch area there.
But now the crosshatch areas.
Well, now you have white. Now, the thing I mentioned about the white, the operating margin there, that, you know, when you look at stage one especially, you say to yourself, my gosh, that's pretty hefty. Why are we only taking 15% out of that? And the reason that you only want to take 15% is, think about about it from the producer's point of view. The producer has spent millions of dollars to acquire the leases, then spent millions more on geological geophysical, spent maybe $10 or $15 million on an exploration well, maybe that much on one or two confirmation wells, and then a third of $1 billion or more on the production facilities to put this in. All this time, this money could have been invested someplace else earning income, and there has been not one dime that comes back. It's like a motion picture industry. You spend $1 billion making The Lord of the Rings. You better have that first week pay $100 million if you're going to overall have something that makes economic sense at the end of the day. And this reflects that. This is not an abnormal characteristic. You need to have, for wildcatters especially, if they're going to come up here and look for oil, they are expecting a stage one picture. And if they're not going to have it, they're not going to explore. Now, the response to this evolution over a field's life, producers' responses, go through this quickly, is the first one is do nothing. Well, that's when that first column, the costs were really tiny. There's no pain, no problem. But if you go back and say, look at the second one here, stage two, now that white area is starting to get squeezed by between the red coming off the top and the rising costs at the bottom. And now producers start saying to themselves, we're going to have to be more efficient. We're going to have to streamline our operations. We're going to have to debottleneck. We're going to have to eliminate unused facilities or consolidate facilities. And one thing, so they do that. Another thing that they do is, as these margins are getting squeezed, it gets harder and harder to find new investment opportunities in the field that are still going to be competitive with your opportunities elsewhere. So you start having some economic casualties, projects that are technically possible but don't make economic sense. And as this stage advances, which can take years, can even take decades, you will have increasingly these things, more drastic measures to try to save costs, and also higher casualties in terms of things that just don't make the grade in being competitive for investment. When you reach the point that there's nothing left that is competitive to invest in for that field, you go into what I call the harvest stage. And again, that's sort of illustrated here in stage three, where you have such a narrow band. I mean, it may be possible that you'd still find some capital investments in a field like that that would pay out of that little thin margin. But I'm saying, for purposes of discussion here, let's say there isn't. So that represents the situation where you've gone into harvest mode. And then you have the running in the red stage. That's phase four. Now, why would you run in the red? Well, you could run in the red at Prudhoe Bay in December of 1998 at $8.16, because you don't believe it's going to stay there forever. And it didn't, thank goodness. And the other thing that you would stay in the red for sometimes is because there's a cost to wrap up your operations. You can't just turn the field off and walk away. You have to plug and abandon the wells. You have to remove all the surface facilities and restore the land. That's in a contract for the use of the land, whether it's the lease or the right-of-way or whatever. That's part of the terms. And there's never going to be a return on that cost. That's just a cost. So you may be willing to operate in the red because that's less expensive than incurring the cost right now. In other words, why go to death if you can only have pain and agony for now?
Yeah, but death's going to come sometime.
Eventually it does. That's right. That's exactly right. The Department of Revenue, to solve this problem, recommended the ELF. And they, once again, reads like Shakespeare, doesn't it? That text, that's by me. But the formula that the department came up with is the important thing. PEL, now this, I apologize for the algebra, but this is actually pretty straightforward. PEL, production at the economic limit. Now what the Department of Revenue meant was, how many barrels do you need to cover the costs of getting that production out of the ground? Period. And then TP, that's your total production. So when you divide, when you take that fraction, that's simply saying, what's the percentage of the production that goes to cover the costs? Subtract that from 100%, that leaves you, what's the percentage of the value of the production that represents operating margin for the producer? That was the ELF. And it would scale the tax rate up with that margin. Operating margin is real high. The ELF would be high, and the tax would be close to the full 15%. Or or 12 and a quarter is, or our first rate was. As that margin gets squeezed, though, the ELF gets smaller and disappears. And with this formula here, 1 minus PEL over TP, this is what happens to those stages that we had before. It's exactly the same, except that the severance tax is being adjusted to reflect the squeeze on the space between the royalty on the top and the operating costs on the bottom. And as your margin gets squeezed, the severance tax disappears. Now, even in stage two, there at that rate, that's a higher tax rate than what Prudhoe Bay was facing before the ELF. Before the ELF, we had a stair-step tax of 5% on the first 300 barrels a day per well, 6% on the next 700, and 8% on anything over 1,000. That works out to 7.8% effective tax rate at Prudhoe Bay. We could increase the tax to 12 or 15% as a base rate and practically get that full amount in stage one and still be ahead of the 7.8% in stage two. That's about a 10% take there in stage two. It's only in stage three and stage four that the tax gets small and disappears, just when you want it to disappear if you want a producer to continue investing so you get as much oil out of the ground as you can. And ultimately, that was the objective that we in the Department of Revenue wanted to see, is to optimize the production and the revenues for the state by getting this tax out of the way in time to avoid shutting production in prematurely and unnecessarily. But one thing that's commonly misunderstood, this so-called tax break that the ELF is, was not something the industry wanted. As I said, when I was working for the state as Director of Petroleum Revenue, it's the idea that I came up with. David Knudsen, the petroleum economist, is the one who came up with that actual formula there. The reason that the industry didn't want it is because it was going to raise the rate at Prudhoe Bay. It allowed us to open the door to raise the rate at Prudhoe Bay without the consequences at the end of field life. And in fact, Prudhoe Bay did go in 1977 from a 7.8% rate to approximately 11.7 under the ELF. And that's a 50% increase in the tax rate. That's why the industry didn't like it. It's not a deal. It's not some sort of thing that industry tried to get. Industry fought it. Now, in 1989, we, of course, had the formula changed. The original formula was driven on well productivity. How close were you to breaking even? Where you assume you need a 300 barrel a day rate to break even. 1989, it added field size to the formula. Total daily production. Larger fields, as a result, have larger ELFs and higher tax rates. Smaller fields have smaller ELFs and lower tax rates. And the dominant factor that determines what rate you have is how large your field is. Now, why was the ELF change proposed in 1989? First of all, to get more revenue. This is partly because in 1987, ELF had been put to sleep in 81 for Prudhoe Bay, and it woke back up at the on the 10th anniversary of Prudhoe Bay production in 1987, and so suddenly there was a reduction in the tax rate from 15% to about 12.5%. That was $100-some-odd million a year in revenue, and the state wanted to recoup most of that. It's a hard bullet to bite. Second, ELF was proposed because the field size parameter to give an incentive for small fields. Marginal fields are fields with relatively low daily production. Small. Third, it was to give an incentive for West Sac viscous oil. New ELF will increase drilling and production and employment at the truly marginal fields, and let's hope someday West Sac. In those fields, the severance tax would be sharply reduced or eliminated entirely. That's a pro-development impact. That's the objective there, was to help West Sac. And I call it viscous oil because the real problems of viscous oil are that it flows slowly through the rock and slowly into the well. And when it does come in the well, it brings a lot of crud from the rock with it. It's like glacial silt. And it fills up your production equipment, and you have to shovel it out. And you get thousands of cubic yards of this stuff that's defined to be hazardous waste as soon as you take it out of the oil, and it has to be disposed of properly, and it has to be handled properly under OSHA and environmental regulations. So API gravity, by the way, only measures the weight of the volume of oil relative to the weight of an equivalent amount of water. It's that ratio. It's totally a function of that. It has nothing to do with the production problems of getting West Sac out of the ground. Finally, the ELF change, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk could afford it. And there was a statement there by a representative from the governor's office that over 20 years, they calculated it would only be at most a few weeks of production, perhaps, that might end up being shut in. They didn't think that was material. So, what it would do, reduce rates for all fields except Peru and Caparic. There you see the quote, would be sharply reduced for marginal fields. Now, one thing again, marginal fields is not what we would use in the dictionary definition of marginal. Marginal fields were the North Slope fields you see there, Milne Point, Lisburn, Endicott, Naukuk, West Sac, Point Thompson, Seal Island, all marginal, and probably any other field that will be discovered in Alaska. I think Senator French made this point as well. The expectation was unless you found a supergiant, another Prudhoe or another Caparic, what would be found would get a lower tax rate under this. It would fall within these marginal concept, whether the tax rate would be sharply reduced or eliminated entirely. And the proof of it is there that you see Endicott is listed up there. In 1989, Endicott had just recently come into production. It was producing 100,000 barrels a day. It had come in early and under budget, was brought online. So it's a stretch to call that marginal, but that's how you have to understand the term being used then. Small was the real focus. And small on a grand scale. Small relative to Prudhoe, small relative to Caparic. Second thing legislators were told is that the tax could go to zero under the new ELF that wouldn't be zero under the old one. And there you see, for marginal fields, under HB 118, the seven sacra will either be sharply reduced or eliminated entirely. Another thing that legislators were told the change would do, smaller fields would pay less tax even with the same well productivity. Now here's one I got quoted earlier from my testimony, and I will quote sort of from memory of my testimony. I gave an example of Prudhoe Bay at approximately 380,000 barrels a day, 500 barrels per well, and Lisburn, 500 barrels a well, but only 40,500 barrels a day. The Prudhoe Bay ELF gave a tax rate of 11.95%. The Lisburn rate was 0.2%. No surprise that you could have very low rates as a result of this formula. The legislature, in adopting it, clearly intended. That's okay. Now, why did the legislature say that was okay? Well, here's the bottom line. The state was going to gain money. Prudhoe Bay was going to pick up $2.5 billion out through 2010. Caparic was going to pay almost $400 million more. The giveaway to the small fields was estimated at $200 million. So the state was a net $2.69 or $2.7 billion ahead out through 2010. In fact, that's exactly what happened. The state's already that far ahead, and we aren't even out there yet. So this is the key thing, that the ELF change in 89 worked exactly the way people were told it was going to work. Prudhoe and Caparic still have a higher production tax. And that is even true today. Caparic is still paying at a higher rate of tax with the 1989 formula than it would have under the prior formula. Now that will change because Caparic is closing in on the 300 barrels a day per well threshold where the tax goes to zero. And Caparic is getting smaller. And the two things are going to take Caparic smaller, but it hasn't reached that yet. Some fields don't pay production tax. That's true. But the Lisburn example was an example of only 0.02%. That's pretty darn close to no production tax. Small fields pay less with same well productivity. Again, that's the Prudhoe versus Lisburn example. And the state is already over $2.7 billion ahead net. So it's met the target before we got to 2010. And again, ELF, the 89 change, was not something industry wanted. It was enacted over the strenuous opposition of the industry. It came at the conclusion of 3 years of struggle in the legislature. The 87 and 88 legislatures had also struggled with a similar ELF proposal to the one that got enacted. And the reason for it was the industry's opposition was the major tax increase for Prudhoe and Caparic. Now here you see what's happened since 1989. And this is also something I'd like to clear up. No one said that investment in the big fields was going to stop altogether. What they said is that that you will have production that falls off the edge because it will cease to compete successfully with the others. And here you see that the black area of the curve is what the natural decline rate would be in these fields, the existing fields in 89. The yellow area that gets added on top, that's the actual production. That's the production that did result from ongoing investment in Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik and Endicott, Lisburn. And then you also see the impact of heavy oil coming in, satellite fields coming in, and at the very end, the impact of wildcat exploration, new fields being discovered, particularly Alpine and North Star coming into production. And as a result, instead of being down at 300,000 barrels a day, where we'd be with a natural decline rate, we're close to a million today, in 2004, because of this investment. The picture is the same as you look forward. Here again, the black area at the bottom is the natural decline rate at 15%. And then you see the additional production that the state stands to get in the future as a result of ongoing investments. And the Department of Revenue itself has said that the investment rate is going to have to double or triple its, from its present level out over the next decade in order to make this vision come true. Once again, you see a contribution over time coming from new investments in the existing fields. You see additional production from satellites. You see some already discovered fields that are marginal coming into production. Those are specifically Liberty Field offshore and Point Thompson. And then you see heavy oil and wildcat exploration. Now, the heavy oil, these figures are from last year's revenue forecast, last spring, a year ago. And I would say heavy oil is probably going to be bigger in DOR's forecast than it was then. Than this would indicate, simply because of the breakthrough that was announced in the drilling technology, where you can drill sideways through a heavy oil reservoir and put thousands of feet of rock in contact with your hole instead of only a few hundred. So that is going to help. But you still will have the problems of the dust bunnies that come up with the oil that turn into this toxic waste or hazardous waste as soon as you separate it from the oil. So the point here is more investment for the future is crucial. There are different kinds of investment that have different economic profiles. And again, look at this. You have wildcat exploration. The profile is you spend millions up front, and you have it exposed at risk for years, and before you see a dime come back on it. When it does come back, you better get it as fast as you can. On the other hand, you have drilling more wells in Prudhoe Bay. That's an upfront expenditure, but as soon as you finish drilling the well, you can turn it on. I mean, so it's a different economic profile. Heavy oil, most of the expenditure on heavy oil, has been on research and development. Hundreds of millions of dollars, not for any specific well or field, but in trying to crack the nut of solving the problems of the viscosity of the oil and the fact that there's this silt that comes out of the rock with it. So all of these are different economic profiles. Because their profiles are different, any given tax change promises to have a different impact on each category of investment. And so what we're saying here is before you go change the tax laws, you should examine to make sure that you don't have the law of unintended consequences, which combines with Murphy's Law to put you behind from where you thought you were going to be. For instance, it was proposed for a while, or at least was rumored to be considered, doing away with the ELF and giving an incentive to wildcatters to put them back to where they would be if they had had an ELF. Well, if that had gone forward, look at this, how much production you would be penalizing, how much production you'd be raising the tax for the sake of getting wildcat production. The state could easily, in that scenario, have ended up behind because the pie shrank faster than it grew the slice that it was taking out of it. So that's why you have to examine the change carefully for the law of unintended consequences. These fiscal notes that you see about the impact of this legislation do not assume that there's a response in the level of production out over the next 10 years if Senate Bill 63 becomes law. Now quickly, what the governor's ELF decision did, it lumped six small fields with Prudhoe, in effect making them all one larger size. And because field size is the dominant factor, the ELF went up. Some of them were not paying a tax or were paying a very low rate of tax. Now they're paying approximately 13%. Prudhoe went up as well and it's paying 13%. Two of the fields that got aggregated, Orion and Polaris, are West Sac viscous oil. There's a good slide that Senator French had showing you where the West Sac formation went. If you look at the upper right-hand corner, it creeps out from the Kaparik unit and goes over into Milne Point and Prudhoe Bay. Those Polaris and Orion are the Prudhoe Bay pieces of West Sac. But they got aggregated. Now specifically about, I'm sorry, Senate Bill 50, I said 63 and I misspoke. I apologize to the sponsor of Senate Bill 63. I don't know what it is.
We knew what you meant.
Well, good. We don't like it for a number of reasons. First of all, it is a... Was that a surprise? Industry, you know, this is a structural tax increase. I think it was brought out earlier, you know, Department of Revenue's expected price forecast is $25.50 in the long term. Now, I will say, you know, there's danger making price forecasts. The last time I worked for the state, I made a forecast that saying long before now, we'd be at $100 a barrel. I did that with Chuck Logsdon. And, you know, we haven't seen that. In fact, in 1980 and 81, those prices of $33 actually equate now to a price of almost 70 after inflation. But anyway, a $25.5 price, if you divide that by $20, which is where you the inflection point where you start raise having this factor that comes in to increase the tax, the price sensitivity factor, 25.5 divided by 20 is 1.275. It's a 27.5% increase across the board for the fields that are that you have here. If DOR's price forecast comes true, simply because of that price forecast. Second, the maximum right now is 15%. It's true no field is paying that, but it's theoretically possible. That's going to increase to 25%, and that's also going to be theoretically possible. The 5% minimum is a heavy burden on satellite development. It may also be a heavy burden on the wet, on the viscous oil development. And in fact, it uses the wrong standard for judging viscous oil. West Sac oil is not best measured by API gravity, but by centipoises, which is the unit to measure how thick it is, you know, maple syrup versus water in terms of how quickly it flows out of the bottle. And it wasn't had an analysis of the consequences of on investments and whether, in fact, you're really going to get all the oil in the coming years that the Department of Revenue assumes. So it makes Alaska less competitive and, in fact, threatens that investment. Because the funny thing is about $50 oil, it's $50 in Russia, too. It's $50 in Trinidad. It's $50 in the United States Gulf of Mexico, in Oklahoma, wherever it may be. The competition doesn't change because of the price of oil. All the boats rise and fall with the tide together. That's the important thing that's overlooked. And that's the end. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions, or if Judy, you had some wrap-up.
Questions? Senator Guest?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize to the committee if people know the answer to this question. I just wanted to clarify. You had stated that price is a netback is a function of price. Price is included there. And so in the production tax is a function of price through the netback. Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I should say yes more loudly, excuse me.
Is price a function in ELF? From what I'm trying to understand, it doesn't look like it's a function within the ELF factor.
No, and again, through the chair, Senator Guest, no, the price is not a parameter in the ELF. Instead, it's a parameter in the netback.
Okay, so if the ELF is zero, regardless of price, if the ELF is zero, the production tax is zero. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, again, yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Make sure I understood that.
Other questions? Seeing no more questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we're going to hold the bill. Next week's schedule is the Senate Bill 85, off-road vehicles use on Dalton Highway, and Senate Bill 144, emission of emission control programs. And then Wednesday it'll be Senate Bill 113, and that is with invitation. Testimony by invitation. And meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, everybody.
We're only going to have an oversight here.